With continual development in technology, hackers and cybercriminals are getting better and better at installing viruses and hacking your electronic devices. We've all had antivirus software, but your run-of-the-mill software just isn't good enough anymore. With Surfshark Antivirus, not only will you have antivirus scans and real-time virus protection, but you'll also have access to a VPN. You'll be protected from targeted ads and tracking. You'll be notified if your data gets leaked by data brokers. And most importantly, it's incredibly easy to set up and use. If you feel like your online protection should be better, use the link in the description and episode notes to get 76% off Surfshark Antivirus today and feel safe every day on your devices. We've all gone to websites only to be presented with a pop-up asking if we'll accept the cookies. Well, did you know that by accepting those cookies, you're allowing that website to collect data on you? These websites will then sell your information to data brokers, who will then create a digital profile of you, which can be used by banks, advertisers, and scammers against you. Well, thanks to Incogni, you no longer need to worry about your data being stolen and sold. Incogni is a tool that will remove your data from these companies for you. All you need to do is sign up, allow Incogni to work for you, and they will contact data brokers on your behalf and guarantee that your digital ID is removed from the internet. Use the link in the description and episode notes and get Incogni today for $6.49 per month on a year plan. And protect your data and digital ID.
Hello, and welcome to the Essential Reads podcast. I'm Isaac, and my goal is to bring to you a bunch of audiobooks from your favourite classic authors such as Orson Welles, Robert Louis Stevenson, John Steinbeck, and many more. Come join me on this journey to help get these books to the masses in an easy, accessible way. Let's start. The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. Chapter 10. When the truck had gone, loaded with implements, with heavy tools, with beds and springs, with every movable thing that might be sold, Tom hung around the place. He mooned into the barn shed, into the empty stalls, and he walked into the implement lean-to and kicked the refuse that was left. Turned a broken mower tooth with his foot. He visited places he remembered. The red bank, where the swallows nested. The willow tree over the pig pen. Two shoats grunted and squirmed at him through the fence. Black pigs, sunning and comfortable. And then his pilgrimage was over. And he went to sit on the doorstep where the shade was lately fallen. Behind him, Ma moved about the kitchen, washing children's clothes in a bucket, and her strong, freckled arms dripped soap suds from the elbows. She stopped her rubbing when she sat down. She looked at him for a long time, and the back of his head when he turned and stared out at the hot sunlight. And then she went back to her rubbing. She said, "Tom, I hope things is all right in California." He turned to look at her. "What makes you think they ain't?" he asked. "Well, nothing. Seems too nice, kinda. I seen the handbills fella pass out, and how much work they is, and the high wages and all, and I seen in the paper how they want folks to come and pick grapes and oranges and peaches. That'd be nice work, Tom, picking peaches. Even if they wouldn't let you eat none, you could maybe snitch a little ratty one sometimes, and it'd be nice under the trees, working in the shade. I'm scared of nice stuff. I ain't got faith. I'm scared something ain't so nice about it." Tom said, "Don't roost your faith bird so high, and you won't do no crawling with the worms." "I know, that's right. That's scripture, ain't it?" "I guess so," said Tom. "I never could keep scripture straight since I read a book named The Winning of Barbara Worth." Ma chuckled lightly, and scrounged the clothes in and out of the bucket. And she wrung out overalls and shirts, and the muscles of her forearms corded out. "Your pa's pa, he quoted scripture all the time. He got it all roiled up, too. It was Dr. Miles' almanac he got mixed up. Used to read every word in that almanac out loud. Letters from folks that couldn't sleep or had lame backs. And later, He'd give them people for a lesson, and he'd say, "That's a parable from Scripture." Your pa and Uncle John troubled him some about it when they'd laugh. She piled wrung clothes like cold wood on the table. "They say it's 2,000 miles to where we're going. How far do you think that is, Tom?" "I've seen it on a map. Big mountains like postcards. Are we going right through 'em? How long you suppose it take to go that far, Tommy?"
"I dunno," he said. 2 weeks, maybe 10 days if you got luck."
"Look, Ma, stop worrying.
I'm going to tell you something about being in the pen. You can't go thinking when you're going to be out. You go nuts. You got to think about that day and the next day and the ball game that day. That's what you got to do. Old-timers does that. A new young fella gets busting his head on the cell door. He's thinking how long it's going to be. Why'd you do that? Just take every day."
"That's a good way," she said, and she filled up her bucket with hot water from the stove, and she put in the dirty clothes, and began punching them down into the soapy water.
"Yes, that's a good way. But I like to think how nice it's going to be, maybe, in California. Never cold, and fruit every place, and people just being the nicest places, little white houses among the orange trees. I wonder, that is, if we all get jobs and all work, maybe we can get one of them little white houses. And the little fellas just go out and pick oranges right off the tree. They ain't gonna be able to stand it. They'll get to yelling so."
Tom watched her working, and his eyes smiled. "It done you good just thinking about it."
"I knowed a fella from California. He didn't talk like us. You'd have knowed he'd come from some faraway place just by the way he talked. But he says there's too many folks looking for work there right now. And he says the folks that pick the fruit live in dirty old camps and don't hardly get enough to eat. He says wages is low and hard to get any."
A shadow crossed her face.
"Oh, that ain't so," she said. "Your father got a handbill on yellow paper telling how they need folks to work. They wouldn't go to that trouble if there wasn't plenty of work. Cost them good money just to send the handbills out. What they want to lie for? And costing them money to lie."
Tom shook his head.
"I don't know, Ma. It's kind of hard to think why they done it. Maybe."
He looked out at the hot sun shining on the red earth.
"Maybe what? Maybe it's nice, like he says. Where'd Grandpa go? Where'd the preacher go?"
Ma was going out of the house, her arms loaded high with the clothes. Tom moved aside to let her pass.
"Preacher says he's gone walk around. Grandpa's asleep in the house. He comes in here in the days and lays down sometimes."
She walked to the line and began to drape pale blue jeans and blue shirts and long grey underwear over the wire. Behind him, Tom heard a shuffling step, and he turned to look in. Grandpa was emerging from the bedroom, and as in the morning, he fumbled with the buttons of his fly.
"I heard talking," he said. "Sons of bitches won't let an old fella sleep. When you bastards get dry behind the ears, you'll maybe learn to let an old fella sleep."
His furious fingers managed to flip open the only 2 buttons on his fly that had been buttoned, and his hand forgot what it had been trying to do. His hand reached in and contentedly scratched under the testicles. Ma came in with wet hands, and her palms puckered and bloated from the hot water and soap.
"Thought you was sleeping. Here, let me button you up."
And though he struggled, she held him and buttoned his underwear and his shirt and his fly.
"You go around a sight," she said,
and let him go. And he sputtered angrily,
"Fellas, come to a nice. To a nice when somebody buttons him. I want to be let to button my own pants."
Ma said playfully, "They don't let people run around with their clothes unbuttoned in California."
"They don't, hey? Well, I'll show 'em. Think they gonna show me how to act out there? Why, I'll go around to hanging out if I wanna.
Ma said. Seems like his language gets worse every year. Showing off, I guess. The old man thrust out his bristly chin, and he regarded Ma with his shrewd, mean, merry eyes.
Well, sir, he said, we'll be a-starting for long now, and by God, there's grapes out there just hanging over in the road. Know what I'm going to do? I'm going to pick me a washtub full of grapes, and I'm going to set 'em and scrooge around and let the juice run down my pants.
Tom laughed. By God, if he lives to be 200, you'll never get Grandpa house broke, he said. You're all set on going, ain't you, Grandpa? The old man pulled out a box and sat heavily on it.
Yes, sir, he said. And goddamn near time, too. My brother went out there 40 years ago. Never did hear nothing about him. Sneaky son bitch he was. Nobody loved him. Run off with a single-action colt mine. If I ever run across him, or his kids, if he got any out in California, I ask him for that colt. But if I know him, and he got any kids, he cuckooed them, and somebody else raising them. I sure will be glad to get out there. Got a feeling it'll make a new fella out of me. Go right to work in the fruit.
Ma nodded. He means it, too, she said. Worked right up to 3 months ago when he throwed his hip out last time.
Damn right, said Grandpa.
Tom looked outward from his seat on the doorstep. Here comes that preacher, walking round from the back side of the barn. Ma said, curiousest grace I ever heard that he give this morning. Wasn't hardly no grace at all, just talking. But the sound of it was like a grace. He's a funny fella, said Tom. Talks funny all the time. Seems like he's talking to himself, though. He ain't trying to put nothing over. Watch the look in his eye, said Ma. He looks baptized. Got that look they call looking through. He sure looks baptized, and a-walking with his head down, a-staring at nothing on the ground. There is a man that's baptized. And she was silent, for Casey had drawn near the door. You're going to get sun shook walking around like that, said Tom. Casey said, well, yeah, maybe. He appealed to them all suddenly, to Ma and Grandpa and Tom. I got to get gone west. I got to go. I wonder if I can go along with you folks. And then he stood, embarrassed by his own speech. Ma looked to Tom to speak, because he was a man. Tom did not speak. She lets him have the chance that was his right, and then she said,
Why, we'd be proud to have you. Course, I can say that now. Pa says all the men gon' talk tonight and figure when we start. I guess maybe we better not say till all the men come. John and Pa and Noah and Tom and Grandpa and Al and Connie. They gon' figure soon as they get back. But if there's room, I'm pretty sure we'll be proud to have you.
The preacher sighed.
I'll go anyways, he said. Something's happening. I went up and I looked at the houses, all empty, and the land is empty. This whole country is empty. I can't stay here no more. Got to go where the folks is going. I'll work in the fields, and maybe I'll be happy.
Ain't you gonna preach? Tom asked.
I ain't gonna preach.
And you ain't going to baptize?
Ma asked. I ain't going to baptize. I'm going to work in the fields. In the green fields. And I'm going to be near folks. And I ain't going to try to teach them nothing. I'm going to try to learn. Going to learn why the folks walk in the grass. Going to hear them talk. Going to hear them sing. Going to listen to kids eating mush. Going to hear husbands and wives a-pounding the mattress in the night. Going to eat with them. And learn.
His eyes were wet and shining.
Gonna lay in the grass, open and honest with anybody that'll have me. Gonna cuss and swear and hear the poetry of folks talking. All that's holy. All that's what I didn't understand. All them things is the good things.
Ma said, Amen.
The preacher sat humbly down on the chopping block beside the door. I wonder what there is for a fellow so lonely. Tom coughed delicately.
For a fellow that preach no more, he began.
Oh, I'm a talker, said Casey. No getting away from that, but I ain't preaching. Preaching is telling folk stuff. I'm asking them. I ain't preaching, is it?
I don't know, said Tom. Preaching is kind of a tone of voice, and preaching's a way of looking at things. Preaching's being good to folk when they want to kill you for it. Last Christmas in McAllister, Salvation Army come and done us good. 3 solid hours of cornet music, and we sat there. They was being nice to us, but if one of us tried to walk out, we'd have drawed solitary. That's preaching. Doing good to a fella that's down and can't smack you in the puss for it. No, you ain't no preacher, but you don't blow no cornets round here. Ma threw some sticks into the stove. I'll get you a bite now, but it ain't much. Grandpa brought his box outside and sat on it and leaned against the wall. Tom and Casey leaned back against the house wall, and the shadow of the afternoon moved out from the house. In the late afternoon, the truck came back, bumping and rattling through the dust, and there was a layer of dust in the bed, and the hood was covered with dust, and the headlights were obscured with a red flower. The sun was setting when the truck came back, and the earth was bloody in its setting light. Al sat, bent over the wheel, proud and serious and efficient, and Pa and Uncle John, as befitted the heads of the clan, had honour seats beside the driver. Standing in the truck bed, holding on to the bars of the sides, rode the others. 12-year-old Ruthie, 10-year-old Winfield, grime-faced and wild, their eyes tired, but excited, their fingers and edges of their mouths black and sticky from licorice whips, whined out of their fathers in town. Ruthie, dressed in a real dress of pink muslin that came below her knees, was a little serious in her young ladiness, but Winfield was still a trifle of a snot nose, a little of a brooder back of the barn, and an invertebrate collector, and smoker of snipes. And whereas Ruthie felt the might, the responsibility, and the dignity of her developing breasts, Winfield was kid wild and cullfish. Beside them, clinging lightly to the bars, stood Rose of Sharon, and she balanced, swaying on the balls of her feet, and took up the road shock in her knees and hams. For Rose of Sharon was pregnant and careful. Her hair, braided and wrapped round her head, made an ash-blonde crown. Her round, soft face, which had been voluptuous and inviting a few months ago, had already put on the barrier of pregnancy, the self-sufficient smile, the knowing perfection look. And her plump body, full of soft breasts and stomach, hard hips and buttocks, that had swung so freely and provocatively as to invite slapping and stroking. Her whole body had become demure and serious. Her whole thought and action were directed inwards on the baby. She balanced on her toes now, for the baby's sake, and the world was pregnant to her. She thought only in terms of reproduction and of motherhood. Connie, her 19-year-old husband, who had married a plump, passionate hoyden, was still frightened and bewildered at the change in her, for there were no more catfights in bed, biting and scratching with muffled giggles and final tears. There was a balanced, careful, wise creature who smiled shyly but very firmly at him. Connie was proud and fearful of Rose of Sharon. Whenever he could, he put a hand on her or stood close so that his body touched her at the hip and shoulder, and he felt that this kept a relation that might be departing. He was a sharp-faced, lean young man of Texas strain, and his pale blue eyes were sometimes dangerous, and sometimes kindly, and sometimes frightened. He was a good, hard worker, and would make a good husband. He drank enough, but not too much, fought when it was required of him, but never boasted. He sat quietly in a gathering, and yet managed to be there and to be recognized. He had not been 50 years old, and so, one of the natural rulers of the family, Uncle John would have preferred not to sit in the honor place beside the driver. He would have liked Rose of Sharon to sit there. This was impossible, because she was young and a woman. But Uncle John sat uneasily. His lonely, haunted eyes were not at ease, and his thin, strong body was not relaxed. Nearly all the time, the barriers of loneliness cut Uncle John off from people and from appetites. He ate little, drank nothing, and was celibate. But underneath, his appetites swelled into pressures until they broke through. And then he would eat of some craved food until he was sick, or he would drink yak or whiskey until he was a shaken paralytic with red wet eyes, or he would raven with lust for some whore in Sallysaw. It was told of him that once he went clear to Shawnee and hired 3 whores in one bed, and snorted and rutted on their unresponsive bodies for an hour, that when one of the appetites was sated, he was sad and ashamed and lonely again. He hid from people, and by gifts tried to make up to all the people for himself. Then he crept into houses and left gum under pillows for children. Then he would cut wood and took no pay. Then he gave away any possession he might have, a saddle, a horse, a new pair of shoes. One could not talk to him then, for he ran away, or if confronted, hid within himself and peeked out of frightened eyes. The death of his wife, followed by months of being alone, had marked him with guilt and shame, and had left an unbreaking loneliness on him. But there were things he could not escape. Being one of the heads of the family, he had to govern, and now he had to sit on the honor seat, beside the driver. The 3 men on the seat were glum as they drove toward home over the dusty road. Al, bending over the wheel, kept shifting eyes from the road to the instrument panel, watching the ammeter needle, which jerked suspiciously, watching the oil gauge and the heat indicator. And his mind was cataloguing weak points and suspicious things about the car. He listened to the whine, which might be the rear end, dry. And he listened to the tappets, lifting and falling. He kept his hand on the gear lever, feeling the turning gears through it. And he had let the clutch out against the brake to test for slipping clutch plates. He might be a musking goat sometimes, but this was his responsibility. This was his truck. This truck. Its running. And its maintenance. If something went wrong, it would be his fault. And while no one would say it, everyone, and Al most of all, would know it was his fault. And so he felt it, watched it, and listened to it. And his face was serious and responsible. And everyone respected him and his responsibility. Even Pa, who was the leader, would hold a wrench and take orders from Al. They were all tired on the truck. Ruthie and Winfield were tired from seeing too much movement, too many faces, from fighting to get licorice whips. Tired from the excitement of having Uncle John secretly slip gum into their pockets. And the men in the seat were tired and angry and sad, for they had got $18 for every movable thing from the farm. The horses, the wagon, the implement, and all the furniture from the house. $18. They had assailed the buyer, argued, but they were rooted when his interest seemed to flag, and he told them he didn't want the stuff at any price. Then they were beaten, believed him, and took $2 less than he had first offered. And now they were weary and frightened, because they had gone against the system they did not understand, and it had beaten them. They knew the team and the wagon were worth much more. They knew the buyer man would get much more, but they didn't know how to do it. Merchandising was a secret to them. And Parr explained, "When I was in the hardware store, I talked to some men I know. They say there's fellas coming in just to buy up the stuff us fellas got to sell when we get out. They say these new fellas is cleaning up, but they ain't nothing we can do about it." Maybe Tommy should've went. Maybe he could've did better, John said. But a fella wasn't gonna take it at all. We couldn't hold it back. These men I know told about that, said Pa. Said the Byers fellas always done that. Scared folks that way. We just don't know how to go about stuff like that. Ma's gonna be disappointed. She'll be mad and disappointed. Al said, when do you think we gonna go, Pa? I dunno. We'll talk her over tonight and decide. I'm sure glad Tom's back. That makes me feel good. Tom's a good boy. Al said, Pa, some fella's talking about Tom. They said he's parole, and they says that means he can't go outside the state. Or if he goes, and they catch him, they send him back for 3 years. Pa looked startled. They said that? Seems like fellas that knowed, not just blowing off. I don't know, said Al. They was just a-talking, and I didn't let on he's my brother. I just stood there and took it in. Pa said, Jesus Christ, I hope that ain't true. We need Tom. I'll ask him about that. We got trouble enough without they chase the hell out of us. I hope that ain't true. We got to talk that out in the open. Uncle John said, Tom, he'll know. They fell silent while the truck battered along. The engine was noisy, full of little clashings, and the brake rods banged. There was a wooden creaking from the wheels, and a thin jet of steam escaped through a hole in the top of the radiator cap. The truck pulled a high, whirling column of red dust behind it. They rumbled up the last rise while the sun was still half-face above the horizon, and they bore down on the house as it disappeared. The brakes squealed when they stopped, and the sound printed in Al's head. No lining left. Ruthie and Winfeld climbed, yelling over the sidewalls, and stopped to the ground. They shouted, Where is he? Where's Tom? And they saw him, standing beside the door. And they stopped, embarrassed, and walked slowly toward him, and looked shyly at him. And when he said, Hello, how you kids doing? They replied softly, Hello, all right. And they stood apart, and watched him secretly. The great brother who had killed a man and been in prison. They remembered how they played prison in the chicken coop and fought for the right to be prisoner. Connie Rivers lifted the high tailgate out of the truck and got down and helped Rose of Sharon to the ground. And she accepted it nobly, smiling her wise and self-satisfied smile, mouth tipped at the corners with a little ferocity. Tom said, Why, it's Rose of Sharon. I didn't know you was coming with him. We was walking, she said. The truck come by and picked us up. And then she said, This is Connie, my husband. And she was grand saying it. The two shook hands, sizing each other up, looking deeply into each other. And then in a moment, each was satisfied. And Tom said, Well, I seen you been busy. She looked down. You do not see, not yet. Ma told me. When's it gonna be? Oh, not for a long time. Not till next winter. Tom laughed. Gonna get him born in an orange ranch, huh? In one of them white houses with orange trees all round. Rose of Sharon felt her stomach with both hands. You do not see, she said. And she smiled her complacent smile and went into the house. The evening was hot, and the thrust of light still flowered up from the western horizon. And without any signal, the family gathered by the truck, and the Congress. And the Congress, the family government, went into session. The film of evening light made the red earth loosened so that its dimensions were deepened, so that a stone, a post, a building had greater depth and more solidity than in the daytime light. And these objects were curiously more individual. A post was more essentially a post, set off from the earth it stood in, and the field of corn it stood out against. The plants were individuals, not the massive crop, and the ragged willow tree was itself standing, free of all other willow trees. The earth contributed to a light in the evening. The front of the grey, paintless house, facing west, was luminous as the moon is. The grey, dusty truck in the yard, before the door, stood out magically in this light, in the overdrawn perspective of a stereopticon. The people, too, were changed in the evening, quieted. They seemed to be part of an organization of the uncurious. They obeyed impulses which registered only faintly in their thinking minds. Their eyes were inward and quiet. And their eyes, too, were loosened in the evening, loosened in dusty faces. The family met at the most important place, near the truck. The house was dead, and the fields were dead. But this truck was the active thing, the living principle. The ancient Hudson, with bent and scarred radiator screen, with grease in dusty globules at the worn edges of every moving part, with hubcaps gone and caps of red dust in their place. This was the new hearth, the living centre of the family. Half passenger car, half truck, high-sided and clumsy. Pa walked around the truck, looking at it, and when he squatted down in the dust, he found a stick to draw with. One foot was flat to the ground, the other rested on the ball and slightly back so that one knee was higher than the other. Left forearm rested on the lower left knee, the right elbow on the right knee, and the right fist cupped for the chin. Pa squatted there, looking at the truck, his chin in his cupped fist, and Uncle John moved towards him and squatted down beside him. Their eyes were brooding. Grandpa came out of the house and saw the two squatting together, and he jerked over and sat on the running board of the truck, facing them. That was the nucleus. Tom and Connie and Noah strolled in and squatted, and the line was a half circle with Grandpa in the opening. And then Ma came out of the house, and Grandma with her, and Rose of Sharon behind, walking daintily. They took their places behind the squatting men. They stood up and put their hands on their hips. And the children, Ruthie and Winfield, hopped from foot to foot beside the women. The children squidged their toes in the red dust, but they made no sound. Only the preacher was not there. He, out of delicacy, was sitting on the ground behind the house. He was a good preacher, and knew his people. The evening light grew softer, and for a while the family sat and stood silently. Then Pa, speaking to no one but to the group, made his report. Got skinned on the stuff we sold. Fella knowed we couldn't wait. Got $18 only. Ma stirred restively, but she held her peace. Noah, the eldest son, asked, "How much all added up we got?" Pa drew figures in the dust and mumbled to himself for a moment. 154, he said, "but Al here says we gonna need better tires. Says these tires won't last." This was Al's first participation in the conference. Always, he had stood behind with the women before, and now he made his report solemnly. "She's old and ornery," he said gravely. "I gave the whole thing a good going over before we bought her. Didn't listen to the fella talking what a hell of a bargain she was. Stuck my finger in the differential, and there wasn't no sawdust. Opened the gearbox, and there wasn't no sawdust. Tested clutch, and rolled her wheels for line. Went under her, and the frame ain't splayed none. She never been rolled. Seen there was a cracked sail in her battery, and made the fella put in a good one. The ties ain't worth a damn, but they're good size. Easy to get. She'll ride like a bull calf, but she ain't shooting no oil. Reason I say buyer is she was a popular car. Wrecking yards full of Houston Super 60s. Wrecking yards full of Hudson Super 6s, and you can buy parts cheap. Could have got a bigger, fancier car for the same money. But parts too hard to get, and too dear. That's what I figured anyway. The last was his submission to the family. He stopped speaking and waited for their opinions. Grandpa was still the titular head, but he no longer ruled. His position was honorary and a matter of custom. But he did have the right of first comment, no matter how silly his old mind might be. And the squatting men and the standing women waited for him.
"You're right, Al," Grandpa said. "I was a squirt just like you, fighting around like a dog wolf. But when they was a job, I done it. You've growed up good."
He finished in the tone of a benediction, and Al reddened a little with pleasure. Pa said, "Sounds right side up to me. If it was horses, we wouldn't have put the blame on Al, but Al's the only automobile fella here." Tom said, "I know some. Worked some in McAllister. Al's right. He done good." And now Al was rosy with the compliment. Tom went on, "I'd like to say, well, that preacher, he wants to go along." He was silent. His words lay in the group, and the group was silent. "He's a nice fella," Tom added. "We've known him a long time. Talks a little wild sometimes, but he talks sensible." And he relinquished the proposal to the family. The light was going gradually. Ma left the group and went into the house, and the iron clang of the stove came from the house. In a moment, she walked back to the brooding council. Grandpa said, "There was two ways of thinking. Some folks used to figure that a preacher was poison luck." Tom said, "This fella says he ain't a preacher no more." Grandpa waved his hand back and forth. "Once a fella's a preacher, he's always a preacher. That's something you can't get shut of. They was some folks figured it was a good, respectable thing to have a preacher come along. If somebody died, preacher buried him. Wedding come due, or overdue, and there's your preacher. Baby come, and you got a christener right under the roof. Me, I always said there was preachers and preachers. Gotta pick 'em. I kind of like this fella. He ain't stiff."
Pa dug his stick into the dust and rolled it between his fingers so that it bored a little hole. "There's more to this than is he lucky or is he a nice fella," Pa said. "We got to figure close. It's a sad thing to figure close. Let's see now. There's Grandpa and Grandma, that's two. Me and John and Ma, that's five. And Noah and Tommy. And Al, that's eight. Rosa, Sean, and Connie is 10. And Ruthie and Winfield is 12. We gotta take the dog, 'cause what'll we do else? Can't shoot a good dog. And there ain't nobody to give him to. And that's 14. Not counting what chickens is left and two pigs," said Noah. Pa said, "I'm to get those pigs salted down to eat on the way. We're gonna need meat. Carry the salt kegs right with us. But I'm wondering if we can all ride, and the preacher too. And can we fit an extra mouth, without turning heads?" he asked. "Can we, Ma?" Ma cleared her throat.
"It ain't can we, it's will we," she said firmly. "As far as kin, we can't do nothing. We got to go to California or nothing. But as far as will, why, we'll do what we will. And as far as will, it's a long time our folks been here, and east before, and I never heard no tale of no Jodes or Hazlitt, neither, ever refusing food and shelter or a lift on the road to anybody that asked. They's been mean, Jodes, but never that mean."
Pa broke in. "But s'pose there just ain't room." He had twisted his neck to look up at her, and he was ashamed. Her tone had made him more ashamed.
"'Spose we just can't all get in the truck.'
"'There ain't room now,' she said. "'There ain't room for more than six, and 12 is gone sure. One more ain't gonna hurt, and a man strong and healthy ain't never no burden. And any time when we get 2 pigs and over $200, and we wondering if we can feed a fella—'
She stopped. And Pa turned back, and his spirit was raw from the whipping. Grandma said,
"A preacher is a nice thing to be with us. He gave a nice grace this morning."
Pa looked over at the face of each one for dissent, and then he said,
"Want to call him over, Tommy? If he's going, he ought to be here."
Tom got up from his hams and went towards the house calling,
"Casey! Oh, Casey!"
A muffled voice replied from behind the house. Tom walked over to the corner and saw the preacher sitting back against the wall, looking at the flashing evening star and the light sky.
"Calling me?"
Casey asked.
"Yeah. We think, as long as you're going with us, you ought to be over with us, helping to figure things out."
Casey got to his feet. He knew the government of families, and he knew that he had been taken into the family. Indeed, his position was eminent, for Uncle John moved sideways, leaving space between Pa and himself for the preacher. Casey squatted down like the others, facing Grandpa enthroned on the running board. Ma went into the house again. There was a screech of a latent hood, and the yellow light flashed up in the dark kitchen. When she lifted the lid of the big pot, the smell of boiling side meat and beet greens came out of the door. They waited for her to come back across the darkening yard, for Ma was powerful in the group.
Pa said, "We gotta figure when to start. Sooner the better. What we got to do before we go is get them pigs slaughtered and salt and pack our stuff and go. Quicker the better now."
Noah agreed.
"If we pitch in, we can get ready tomorrow, and we can go bright the next day."
Uncle John objected.
"Can't chill no meat in the heat of the day. Wrong time of year for slaughtering. Meat'll be soft if it don't chill."
"Well, let's do her tonight. She'll chill tonight some, much as she's gonna. After we eat, let's get her done. Got salt?"
Ma said,
"Yes, got plenty salt, and 2 nice kegs, too."
"Well, let's get her done then," said Tom.
Grandpa began to scrabble about trying to get a purchase to arise.
"Getting dark," he said. "I'm getting hungry. Come time we get to California, I'll have a big bunch of grapes in my hand all the time, a-nibbling off it all the time, by God."
He got up, and the men arose. Ruthie and Winfield hopped excitedly about in the dust, like crazy things. Ruthie whispered hoarsely to Winfield,
"Killing pigs and going to California. Killing pigs and going. All the same time."
And Winfield was reduced to madness. He stuck his finger against his throat and made a horrible face and wobbled about, weakly shrilling,
"Oh, I'm a pig. Look, I'm an old pig. Look at the blood, Ruthie."
And he staggered and sank to the ground and waved his arms and legs weakly. But Ruthie was older, and she knew the tremendousness of the time.
"And going to California," she said again.
And she knew this was the great time in her life so far. The adults moved towards the lighted kitchen through the deep dusk, and Ma served them greens and side meat in tin plates. But before Ma ate, she put the big round washtub on the stove and started the fire to roaring. She carried buckets of water until the tub was full, and then around the tub she clustered the buckets full of water. The kitchen became a swamp of heat, and the family ate hurriedly and went out to sit on the doorstep until the water should get hot. They sat, looking out at the dark, at the square of light the kitchen lantern threw on the ground outside the door, with a hunched shadow of Grandpa in the middle of it. Noah picked at his teeth thoroughly with a broom straw. Ma and Rose of Sharon washed up the dishes and piled them on the table. And then, all of a sudden, the family began to function. Pa got up and lighted another lantern. Noah, from the box in the kitchen,
brought out the bow-bladed butchering knife and whetted it on a worn little carborundum stone. And he laid the scraper on the chopping block and the knife beside it. Pa bought 2 sturdy sticks, each 3 feet long, and pointed the ends with an axe. And he tied strong ropes, double half-hitched, to the middle of the sticks. He grunted, "Shouldn't have sold those single trees. All of them." The water in the pot steamed and rolled. Noah asked,
"Gonna take the water down there, or bring the pigs up here?"
"Pigs up here," said Pa. "You can't spill a pig and scald yourself like you can hot water."
"Water about ready?"
"Just about," said Ma.
"All right, Noah. You and Tom and Al come along. I'll carry the light. We'll slaughter down there and bring him up here."
Noah took his knife, and Al the axe, and the 4 men moved down on the sty, their legs flickering in the lantern light. Ruthie and Winfield skittered along, hopping over the ground. At the sty, Pa leaned over the fence, holding the lantern. The sleepy young pigs struggled to their feet, grunting suspiciously. Uncle John and the preacher walked down to help.
"All right," said Pa. "Stick 'em, and we'll run 'em up and scald at the house."
Noah and Tom stepped over the fence. They slaughtered quickly and efficiently. Tom struck twice with the blunt head of the axe, and Noah, leaning over the felled pigs, found the great artery with his cutting knife and released the pulsing streams of blood. Then over the fence with the squealing pigs. The preacher and Uncle John dragged one by the hind legs, and Tom and Noah the other. Pa walked along with the lantern, and the black blood made 2 trails in the dust. At the house, Noah slipped his knife between the tendon and the bone of the hind legs. The pointed sticks held the legs apart, and the carcasses were hung from the 2x4 rafters that stuck out from the house. Then the men carried the boiling water and poured it over the black bodies. Noah slit the bodies from end to end and dropped the entrails out to the ground. Pa sharpened 2 more sticks to hold the bodies open to the air, while Tom, with the scrubber, and Ma, a dull knife, scraped the skins to take out the bristles. Al brought a bucket and shoveled the entrails into it, and dumped them onto the ground far away from the house. And 2 cats followed him, mewing loudly, and the dogs followed him, growling lightly at the cats. Pa sat on the doorstep and looked at the pigs hanging in the lantern light. The scraping was done now, and only a few drops of blood continued to fall from the carcasses into the black pool on the ground. Pa got up and went to the pigs and felt them with his hand, and then he sat down again. Grandpa, Grandma and Grandpa went towards the barn to sleep, and Grandpa carried a candle lantern in his hand. The rest of the family sat quietly about the doorstep, Connie and Al and Tom on the ground, leaning their backs against the house wall, Uncle John on a box, Pa in the doorway. Only Ma and Rose of Sharon continued to move about. Ruthie and Winfield were sleepy now, but fighting it off. They quarrelled sleepily out in the darkness. Noah and the preacher squatted side by side, facing the house. Pa scratched himself nervously, and took off his hat and ran his fingers through his hair. "Tomorrow we'll get that pork soldered early in the morning, and then we'll get the truck loaded, all but the beds, and next morning we'll go off. Hardly is a day's work in all that," he said uneasily. Tom broke in. "We'll be moaning around all day, looking for something to do." The group stirred uneasily. "We could get ready by daylight and go," Tom suggested. Pa rubbed his knee with his hand, and the restiveness spread to all of them. Noah said,
"Probably wouldn't hurt the meat to get right down in salt. Cut her up. She'd cool quicker anyways."
It was Uncle John who broke over the edge, his pressures too great.
"What are we hanging round for? I want to get shut of this. Now we're going. Why don't we go?"
And the revolution spread to the rest.
"Why don't we go? Get sleep on the way."
And a sense of hurry crept into them. Pa said,
"They say it's 2,000 miles. That's a hell of a long way.
We ought to go."
Noah, you can get me that meat cut up, and we can put all the stuff in the truck. Ma put her head out of the side door.
How about we forget something not seen in the dark?
We could look round after daylight, said Noah.
They sat still then, thinking about it. But in a moment, Noah got up and began to sharpen the bow-bladed knife on his little worn stone.
Ma, he said, get that table cleared.
And he stepped to a pig, cut a line down one side of the backbone, and began peeling the meat forward off of the ribs. Pa stood up, excitedly. We got to get the stuff together, he said. Come on, you fellas. And now that they were committed to going, the hurry infected all of them. Noah carried the slabs of meat into the kitchen and cut it into small salting blocks, and Ma patted the coarse salt in, laid it piece by piece in the kegs, careful that no two pieces touched each other. She laid the slabs like bricks and pounded salt into the spaces, and Noah cut up the side meat and he cut up the legs. Ma kept her fire going, and as Noah cleaned the ribs and spines and leg bones of all meat he could, she put them in the oven to roast for gnawing purposes. In the yard and in the barn, the circles of lantern light moved about, and the men brought together all the things to be taken and piled them by the truck. Rose of Sharon brought out all of the clothes the family possessed. The overalls, the thick-soled shoes, the rubber boots, the worn best suits, the sweaters and sheepskin coats. And she packed these tightly into a wooden box and got into the box and tramped them down. And then she brought out the print dresses and shawls, the black cotton stockings and the children's clothes, small overalls and cheap print dresses. And she put these into the box and tramped them down. Tom went to the tool shed and brought what tools were left to go. A handsaw, a set of wrenches, a hammer, and a box of assorted nails, a pair of pliers, and a flat file, and a set of rat-tail ties. And Rose of Sharon brought out the big piece of tarpaulin and spread it on the ground behind the truck. She struggled through the door with the mattress. Three double ones and a single. She piled them on the tarpaulin and brought armloads of folded ragged blankets and piled them up. Ma and Noah worked busily at the carcasses, and the smell of roasting pork bones came from the stove. The children had fallen, by the way, in the late night. Winfeld laid curled up in the dust outside the door, and Ruthie, sitting on a box in the kitchen where she had gone to watch the butchering, had dropped her head back against the wall. She breathed easily in her sleep, and her lips were parted over her teeth. Tom finished with the tools and came into the kitchen with his lantern, and the preacher followed him.
"Garden a buckboard," Tom said. "Smell that meat. And listen to her crackle."
Ma laid the bricks of meat in a keg and poured salt around and over them and covered the layer with salt and patted it down. She looked up at Tom and smiled a little at him, but her eyes were serious and tired.
"Be nice to have pork bones for breakfast, fellas," she said.
The preacher stepped beside her.
"Leave me salt down this meat," he said. "I can do it. There's other stuff for you to do."
She stopped her work then and inspected him oddly, as though he suggested a curious thing. And her hands were crusted with salt, pink and fluid from the fresh pork.
"It's woman's work," she said finally.
"It's all work," the preacher replied. "There's too much of it to split it up to man's work or woman's work. You got stuff to do. Leave me to salt the meat."
Still for a moment, she stared at him, and then she poured water from a bucket into the tin wash basin, and she washed her hands. The preacher took up the blocks of pork and patted on the salt while she watched him, and he laid them in the kegs as she had. Only when he had finished a layer and covered it carefully and patted down the salt was she satisfied. She dried her bleached and blotted hands. Tom said,
"Ma, what stuff we gonna take from here?"
She looked quickly about the kitchen.
"The bucket," she said. "All the stuff to eat with, plates and
cups and the spoons and knives and forks. Put all them in that drawer and take the drawer. The big fry pan and the big stew kettle, the coffee pot. And when it's cool, take the rack out of the oven. That's good over a fire. I'd like to take that wash tub, but I guess there ain't room. I'll wash the clothes in the bucket. Don't do no good to take little stuff. You can cook the little stuff in a big kettle, but you can't cook the big stuff in a little pot. Take the bread pans, all of them. They fit down inside each other. She stood and looked about the kitchen. You just take that stuff I told you, Tom. I'll fix up the rest. The big can of pepper, and the salt, and the nutmeg, and the grater. I'll take all that stuff just at last. She picked up a lantern and walked heavily into the bedroom, and her bare feet made no sound on the floor. The preacher said, "She looks pretty tired." "Women always tired," said Tom. "That's just the way women is. Except at meeting once and again." "Yeah, but tired and that. Real tired. Like, she's sick tired." Ma was just through the door, and she heard his words. Slowly, her relaxed face tightened, and the lines disappeared from the taunt, muscular face. Her eyes sharpened, and her shoulders straightened. She glanced about the stripped room. Nothing was left in it, except trash. The mattress, which had been on the floor, was gone. The bureaus were sold. On the floor lay a broken comb, and an empty talcum powder can, and a few dust mites. Ma set her lantern on the floor. She reached behind one of the boxes that had served as chairs and brought out a stationery box, old and soiled and cracked at the corners. She sat down and opened the box. Inside were letters, clippings, photographs, a pair of earrings, a little gold signet ring, and a watch chain braided of hair and tipped with gold swivels. She touched the letters with her fingers, touched them lightly, and she smoothed the newspaper clipping, on which there was an account of Tom's trial. For a long time she held the box, looking over it, and her fingers disturbed the letters, and then lined them up again. She bit the lower lip, thinking, remembering. And at last, she made up her mind. She picked out the ring, the watch charm, the earrings, dug under the pile, and found one gold cufflink. She took a letter from an envelope and dropped the trinkets in the envelope. She folded the envelope over and put it into her dress pocket. Then, gently and tenderly, closed the box and smoothed the top carefully with her fingers. Her lips parted, and then she stood up, took her lantern, and went back into the kitchen. She lifted the stove lid and laid the box gently among the coals. Quickly, the heat browned the paper. A flame licked up and over the box. She replaced the stove lid, and instantly the fire sighed up and breathed over the box. Out in the dark yard, working in the lantern light, Pa and Al loaded the truck. Tools on the bottom, but handy to reach in case of a breakdown. Boxes of clothes next, and kitchen utensils in a gunny sack. Cutlery and dishes in their box. Then the gallon bucket tied on behind. They made the bottom of the load as even as possible, and filled the spaces between the boxes with rolled blankets. Then, over the top, they laid the mattresses, filling the truck in level. And last, they spread the big tarpaulin over the load, and Al made holes in the edge, 2 feet apart, and inserted little ropes, and tied it down to the side bars of the truck. "Now, if it rains," he said, "we'll tie it to the bar above, and the folks can get underneath, out of the wet. Up front will be dry enough." And Pa applauded. "That's a good idea." "That ain't all," Al said. "First chance I get, I'll go find a long plank and make a ridge pole and put that tarp over that. And then it'll be covered in, and the folks be out of the sun, too." And Pa agreed. "That's a good idea." "That's a good idea. Why didn't you think of that before?" "I ain't had the time," said Al. "Ain't had the time? Why, Al, you've had all the time to coyote all over the country. God knows where you've been these last 2 weeks. Stuff a fella gotta do when he's leaving the country," said Al. And then he lost some of his assurance. Pa? He asked. You glad to be gone, Pa?
Huh? Well, sure. Leastwise, yeah. We had hard times here. Course it'll be different out there. Plenty of work and everything nice and green. And little white houses and orange growing around.
Is it oranges everywhere?
Well, maybe not everywhere, but plenty places.
The first grey of daylight began in the sky, and the work was done. The kegs of pork ready, the chicken coop ready to go on top. Ma opened the oven and took out the pile of roasted bones, crisp and brown, with plenty of gnawing meat still left. Ruthie half awakened and slipped down from the box and slept again. But the adults stood round the door, shivering a little and gnawing at the crisp pork.
Guess we ought to wake Grandma and Grandpa, Tom said. Getting along towards the day.
Ma said, kinda hate to. Till last minute. They need to sleep. Ruthie and Winfield ain't hardly getting no real rest neither.
Well, they can all sleep on top of the load, said Pa. It'll be nice and comfortable there.
Suddenly, the dog started up from the dust and listened, and then, with a roar, went marking off into the distance.
Well, what in hell is that?
Pa demanded. In a moment, they heard a voice speaking reassuringly to the barking dogs, and the barking lost its fierceness. Then, footsteps, and a man approached. It was Muley Graves, his hat pulled low. He came near, timidly.
Morning, folks, he said.
Why, Muley, Pa waved the ham bone he held.
Step in and get some pork for yourself, Muley. Go easy.
Well, no, said Muley. I ain't hungry, exactly.
Oh, get it, Muley, get it here.
And Pa stepped into the house and brought out a handful of spare ribs.
I wasn't aiming to eat none of your stuff, he said. I was just walking around and I thought hey, he'd be going and I'd maybe say goodbye.
Going in a little while now, said Pa. You'd have missed us if you'd come about an hour later. All packed up, see?
All packed up, Muley looked at the loaded truck. Sometimes I wished I'd go and find my folks.
Ma asked, did you hear from him out in California?
No, said Muley. I ain't heard, but I ain't been looking the post office. I ought to go in sometimes.
Al, go down and wake up Grandma and Grandpa. Tell them to come eat. We're gone before long.
And as Al sauntered towards the barn,
Muley, you want to squeeze in with us and go? We'll try to make room for you.
Muley took a bite of meat from the edge of a rib bone and chewed it.
Sometimes I think I might, but I know I won't, he said. I know perfectly well the last minute I'd run and hide like a damn old graveyard ghost.
Noah said,
you're gonna die out in the field someday, Muley. I know. I thought about that. Sometimes it seems pretty lonely, and sometimes it seems all right, and sometimes it seems good. It don't make no difference. But if you come across my folks, that's really what I come to say. If you come on any of my folks in California, tell them I'm well. Tell them I'm doing all right. Don't let on I'm living this way. Tell them I come to them as soon as I get the money.
Ma asked, and will you?
No, Muley said softly. No, I won't. I can't go away. I got to stay now. Time back, I might have went, but not now. Fella gets to thinking, and he gets to knowing. I ain't never gone.
The light of the dawn was a little sharper now. It paled the lanterns a little. Al came back with Grandpa, struggling and limping by his side.
He wasn't sleeping, Al said. He was sitting out back of the barn. There's something wrong with him.
Grandpa's eyes had dulled, and there was none of the old meanness in them.
Ain't nothing the matter with me, he said. I just ain't a-goin'.
Not goin'? Pa demanded.
What do you mean you ain't a-going? Why, here we're all packed up, ready. We gotta go. We got no place to stay.
I ain't staying for you to stay, said Grandpa. You go right along. Me, I'm staying. I gave her a good going over, all night mostly. This here's my country. I belong here. I don't give a goddamn if there's oranges and grapes crowding a fella out of bed even. I ain't a-going. This country ain't no good, but it's my country. No, you all go ahead. I'll just stay right here where I belong.
They crowded near to him. Pa said, You can't, Grandpa. This here land is going under the tractors. Who'd cook for you? How'd you live? You can't stay here. Why, with nobody to take care of you, you'd starve.
Grandpa cried, God damn it, I'm an old man, but I can still take care of myself. How's Muley here getting along? I can get along good as him. I tell you, I ain't going, and you can lump it. Take Grandma with you if you want, but you ain't taking me, and that's the end of it.
Pa said helplessly, Now, listen to me, Grandpa. Just listen to me a minute.
I ain't going to listen to you. I told you what I'm going to do.
Tom touched his father on the shoulder. Pa, come in the house. I want to tell you something. As they moved towards the house, he called, Ma, come here a minute, will you? In the kitchen, one lantern burned, and the plate of pork bones was still piled high. Tom said, Listen, I know Grandpa got the right to say he ain't going, but he can't stay. We know that.
Sure he can't stay, said Pa.
Well, look, if we gotta catch him and tie him down, we'd be liable to hurt him, and he'll get so mad he'll hurt himself. Now, we can't argue with him. If we could get him drunk, it'd be all right. You got any whiskey?
No, said Pa. There ain't a drop of whiskey in the house. And John got no whiskey. He never has none when he ain't drinking.
Ma said, Tom, I got a bottle of soothing syrup I got for Winfield when he had them earaches. Think that might work? Used to put Winfield to sleep when his earache was bad.
Might, said Tom. Get it, Ma. We'll give her a try anyways.
I throwed it out in the trash pile, said Ma. She took the lantern and went out, and in a moment she came back, bottle half full of black medicine. Tom took it from her and tasted it. Don't taste bad, he said. Make a cup of black coffee, good and strong. Let's see. Says 1 teaspoon. Better put a lot, couple tablespoons. Ma opened the stove and put a kettle inside, down next to the coals. And she measured a cup of water and coffee into it.
Have to give it to him in a can, she said. We got all the cups packed.
Tom and his father went back outside.
Fella got a right to say what he gonna do. Say, who's eating spare ribs? Said Grandpa.
We've ate, said Tom. Ma's fixing you a cup of coffee and some pork. He went into the house, and he drank his coffee and ate his pork. The group outside in the growing dawn watched him quietly through the door, and they saw him yawn and sway, and they saw him put his arms on the table and rest his head on his arms, and go to sleep.
He was tired anyway, said Tom. Leave him be.
Now they were ready. Grandma, giddy and vague, saying,
What's all this? What are you doing now so early?
And Ruthie and Winfield were awake, but quiet with the pressure of tiredness, and still half dreaming. The light was stiffening rapidly over the land, and the movement of the family stopped, and they stood about, reluctant to make the first active move to go. They were afraid now that the time had come. Afraid the same way Grandpa was afraid. They saw the shed take shape against the light, and they saw the lanterns pale until they no longer cast their circles of yellow light. The stars went out, few by few, toward the west, and still the family stood about like dreamwalkers, and their eyes focused panoramically, seeing no detail but the whole dawn, the whole land, the whole texture of the country at once. Only Muley Graves prowled about restlessly, looking through the bars into the truck, thumping the spare tires hung on the back of the truck. And at last, Muley approached Tom.
"You going over state line?"
he asked.
"You won't break your parole?"
And Tom shook himself, free of the numbness.
"Jesus Christ, it's near sunrise,"
he said loudly. "We gotta get going." And the others came out of their numbness and moved towards the truck. "Come on," said Tom. "Let's get Grandpa on." Pa and Uncle John and Tom and Al went into the kitchen where Grandpa slept, his forehead down on his arms and a line of drying coffee on the table. They took him under the elbows and lifted him to his feet, and he grumbled and cursed thickly like a drunken man. Out the door, they boosted him, and when they came to the truck, Tom and Al climbed up, and leaning over, hooked their hands under his arms and lifted him gently up and laid him on top of the load. Al untied the tarpaulin, and they rolled him under, and put a box under the tarp beside him, so that the weight of the heavy canvas would not be upon him.
"I gotta get that ridge pole fixed," Al said. "Do it tonight when we stop."
Grandpa grunted and fought weakly against awakening, and when he was finally settled, he went deeply to sleep again. Pa said, "Ma, you and Grandpa sit with Al for a while. We'll change round so it's easier, but you start out that way." They got into the cab, and then the rest swarmed up on top of the load. Connie and Rose of Sharon, Pa and Uncle John, Ruthie and Winfield, Tom and the preacher. Noah stood on the ground, looking up at the great load sitting on top of the truck. Al walked around, looking underneath at the springs.
"Holy Jesus," he said. "Them springs is flat as hell. Lucky I bucked under 'em."
Noah said,
"How about the dogs, Pa?"
"I forgot the dogs," Pa said. He whistled shrilly, and one bouncing dog ran in. But only one. Noah caught him and threw him up on top, where he sat rigid and shivering at the height.
"Got to leave the other two,"
Pa called.
"Muley, will you look after 'em some? See they don't starve."
"Yeah," said Muley. "I'd like to have a couple dogs. Yeah, I'll take 'em."
"Take the chickens, too," Pa said.
Al got into the driver's seat, and the starter whirred and caught and whirred again. And then the loose roar of six cylinders and a blue smoke behind.
"So long, Muley," Al called.
And the family cried, "Goodbye, Muley." Al slipped in the low gear and let in the clutch. The truck shuddered and strained across the yard, and the second gear took hold. They crawled up the little hill, and the red dust arose about them.
"Christ, what a load," said Al. "We ain't making no time on this trip."
Ma tried to look back, but the body of the load cut off her view. She straightened her head and peered straight ahead along the dirt road, and a great weariness was in her eyes. The people on top of the load did not look back. They saw the house and the barn and a little smoke still rising from the chimney. They saw the windows reddening under the first colour of the sun. They saw Muley standing forlornly in the dooryard looking after them. And then the hill cut them off. The cotton fields lined the road, and the truck crawled slowly through the dust towards the highway and the west.
Thank you so very much for listening. If you enjoyed, please leave a review. And if you really want to support me, share this chapter with your friends, family, and whoever you feel would enjoy it. And if you really wish to support me, head to my Patreon. The link is in the episode notes. If you choose to follow the podcast, you'll have 3 new chapters per week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Once again, I thank you for listening. And until next time, bye-bye.